So I've been doing a monthly study group with Tony Bernhardt. Some of you know Tony, and he's been here often, and we love his teaching. And right now we're reading The Connected Discourses of the Buddha, the Samyutta Nikaya. And you don't get a lot of teachings out of this book, you know. Mostly what we teach from is the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle-length discourses. These are called connected because there'll be, like in this case, 59 suttas about the same thing. So they're connected. What I did to prepare for tonight was, and I did prepare for tonight, even though I didn't do a write-up on it. What I did to prepare for tonight was to actually look for which of these really grabbed me. Which of the suttas in here was something that just like, wow, you know, that's really something. One of Tony's teachers compares this to rice pudding, this book, to rice pudding. So there's a lot of sort of blah, and then all of a sudden, every once in a while, there's like, ooh, you know, there's a raisin in this rice pudding. Whoa, man, that's really, you know, really noticeable. And the rest of it's sort of blah. So what happens is that in this formula, many of these little discourses, the suttas or little talks that the Buddha gave or that somebody recalled him saying, and they're written down by monks that were hanging around him. So what happens with a lot of these is that they're what the translator, Bhikkhu Bodhi, who's an American monk, the translator calls template suttas. So you'll read, you know, 12 suttas, and they'll be exactly identical, except one word will change. Or they'll be exactly identical, except that the name of the person they're addressed to will be different, or the place where it was given. So, you know, this is not like reading Maya Angelou or Amy Tan, you know? It's to be read in a completely different way. First of all, understanding that this is what was written down several hundred years after the Buddha actually lived, first of all. And second of all, to realize that it was written with a purpose to transmit, you know, certain ideas that might be useful in our practice. That's how I approach this. Not as a, you know, scholarly study of, well, why'd they change that word and not that one? But to actually figure out, well, what is it that the Buddha was trying to teach or the people that were hanging around with the Buddha were trying to pass on that they had learned? What is it that is helpful for us in our lives? So that's what we'll get to by the time we're finished tonight, I hope. Yes?
I just wanted to ask, what do you need to call up in yourself to come to a place where you can actually do this? Because, I mean, from where in my inner being, the prospect of doing what you're doing seems really, really hard. Really, really hard. And so I just wondered, there's a quality that you have to be able to see that, that you wouldn't spend your time. It's an enormous amount of your life and time, it seems to me. I'm just curious if you could, because if there's a patience or something, and I'd love to have it.
Yeah. So would I. That's a good question, Miriam. These aggregates of clinging that I'm talking about tonight. So when I trained with Dennis from 2006 to 2008, the first time I talked about these was in 2009. We were going through the Satipatthana Sutta, you know, one chapter at a time. And it took us a year, actually, Dennis and Diana and me, to get through that whole thing. And then 5 years ago, I talked about this at Rockland, and then we have three people here from Rockland tonight, which is really sweet. And in coming back to it, I think the primary quality is humility, to know, this is deep. This stuff is, I mean, it's not just thick, it's deep, you know? And And there's so much that we encounter that is just humbling. You know, you read it, you don't understand it. And the assumption from experience is that it's probably right on some level, right? Because I haven't read anything that I later found out, oh, no, that's no. What happens is you read something and it's like, that makes no sense at all. And 5 years later, 10 years later, it's like, oh, aha, yeah. So part of it's humility. Part of it is what we're going to be talking about tonight is just getting out of the way and letting the truth with a small t, the truth of this, whatever the truth is for me at this time, let that come out without worrying about whether someone, you know, is going to listen to this talk 10 years later and say, wait, 10 years ago you said X, you know, but now you're saying Y. Because knowing that all this evolves and it's all impermanent and, you know, insubstantial, and that's actually what we're going to be talking about tonight, is the way that this way of deconstructing reality using the aggregates is very helpful in that it shows us how impermanent and insubstantial and unsatisfactory life can be. So that's kind of how I approach it. I feel very honored to be in this seat, of course, and so you know, what do you do with that? So yeah, thanks for your question. So what are these aggregates of clinging? So 20 to 30% of the suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya, the one that we often teach from, are about this, about these five aggregates of clinging. What it is it is one of the two unique ways that the Buddha came up with for deconstructing life, for pulling apart and analyzing what is it to be alive, to be human. How do we operate? What's our operating system? One of them was dependent origination. Dad had not been taught from any of the religious systems that were happening at the time of the Buddha, which is the what we call the cycle of reactivity in here, kind of the how and why we suffer, the functional mechanism of the way that experience rolls out and that we end up personalizing it and identifying with it and attaching. And this is the second way, these five aggregates of clinging. So what the five aggregates of clinging are they are the five things that we hold on to create a sense of self. That's kind of the simplest way I can think of the shoestring before we actually launch into the detail. The five aspects of being that we hold on to create a sense of self, or to feel secure, or to protect ourselves against the insubstantiality of the way things are. Okay? The scariness of life. They're the five things that we hold on to. Now, when I see any of these Buddhist lists, whether it's the 12 links of dependent origination or the Four Noble Truths or the five whatever, in this case, the five aggregates of clinging, I think, well, could there have been six? Could there be five others? I think so, you know? I think that the Buddha... I know that the Buddha had this unique ability to teach in a way that whoever he was talking to got it. You know, that's one I'd like to have. It's a characteristic I'd like to have, but you kind of have to be a Buddha to be able to do that, to know the minds at some level of everyone present in the room and, you know, address the teaching to everyone that's there. But he chose these five. It could be that they were revealed to him in some, you know, deep insight when he was meditating. He doesn't really talk about where these come from. But the fact that he repeats this teaching over and over and over again, including, you know, specifically to his son, Rahula, as a way of getting free, tells us that this was really important. And in fact, a lot of the repetition that's in the Pali Canon was the teaching method of the day. It was, rather than say, very, 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 very important, you would say, this teaching is important. It's important because it's important, and it's important to know it's important. So you would repeat yourself rather than use a bunch of adjectives to define something. So the repetition, even though it's sort of tedious to us, is what the repetition is saying is that this is important. And that's why there's so many suttas on it. So in this book, within this there are five books, and the third one is all about aggregates of clinging. Every one of the 59 suttas in that section is about the five aggregates of clinging. So they're pretty important. They get repeated. And the whole fifth of this book, well, I don't know if the volume is a fifth, but one whole book of the five books in here, one whole book is about the aggregates of clinging. So khanda is the Pali word for the aggregates, and samyutta is the connected discourses. So this is the khanda samyutta, the whole third part. And just so you know, a bunch of this book is actually the notes from the translator. So it's not all the text. And he actually includes most of the commentaries on the original text. So it's not quite as scary as it looks. Okay. So let's just start going through them one by one. The reason that this particular sutta really caught my attention is that it has these very vivid similes that help explain the five aggregates. Usually the suttas just say, form is impermanent, feeling tone is impermanent, perception is impermanent, the mental formations are impermanent, consciousness is impermanent, and kind of goes through this list and you're like, wow, they're sort of gone before you get a hold of what's happening. But in this one, he uses these very vivid similes to explain each one. So we're just going to go through them one by one. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Ayodhya on the bank of the river Ganges. So as you know, the Buddha taught his entire life in the Ganges River Valley, some part of that watershed. There the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus thus. Bhikkhus, that means practitioners, if anybody that's trying to do this practice. Bhikkhus, suppose that this river Ganges was carrying along a great lump of foam. A person with good sight would inspect it, ponder it, and carefully investigate it, and it would appear to them to be void, hollow, insubstantial. For what substance could there be in a lump of foam? So too, bhikkhus, whatever kind of form there is, so the form is the first of the five aggregates of clinging, whether past, future, or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, a bhikkhu inspects it, ponders it, and carefully investigates it, and it would appear to be void, hollow, insubstantial. For what substance could there be in form? So form means the material world. The first of these is material, all the other ones are mental, all the other ones are going to follow. Form means, in one sense, it's the four elements, fire, water, earth, and air, that sort of interact, at least in the cosmology of the day, interact to create everything that we see in the physical world. Everything is part fire, part water, part air, in different proportions, and the proportions determine whether something's a solid, a liquid, a gas, whether it's moving, whether it's water has the property of adherence. So, when you wet your finger, you can pick up your contact lens. that's that quality of adherence that that liquid has. So when you feel adherence, you know, like when your palms stick to each other, you're experiencing the quality of the water element. That's one way of looking at form. Another way of looking at form is just to look at like a silhouette. So, you know, we often will look at something and sort of make a bunch of assumptions about it. And I like to look at silhouettes of things because that's really all we're looking at when you think about it. When we look at any physical object in the world, we're not seeing the whole thing. I mean, for one thing, I'm looking at the front of all of you. You've got a backside that I'm not seeing. And ditto as you look at me, you know, there's something happening. You know, I have another, you're not seeing the whole person, right? You're not seeing the 365. And then there's all kinds of non-visible things that are happening, right? In terms of energy and all of that. There's processes going on that we can't observe with the heartbeat, the lungs, all of that's happening, digestion, that's all going on. We can't see that. So I sometimes like to get a grasp on this idea of the insubstantiality of form. I like to look at silhouettes. Or we used to get a lot more fog in Sacramento than we do now, but I like looking at things in the fog. They just sort of hint at themselves, you know? And they leave a lot to the imagination. And I kind of like that. That's sort of a lesson in actually the fact that we aren't seeing clearly 100% all the time when we think we are. You know, we fool ourselves into thinking, oh, I'm really seeing exactly what's present right now. But there's something that we're not seeing going on all the time. And so this awareness of form, the fact that form is, the words he's using here, void, hollow, and insubstantial. So you probably recognize void and hollow as synonyms for emptiness. So this idea that physical forms are empty of any inherent, permanent, lasting existence, right? Which is one of the three characteristics that we try to have insights into in this practice. You know, what do we call it insight meditation. Well, what are we having insights about? You know, well, certainly in the beginning, we have insights about that terrible thing I said yesterday to my friend that made them feel bad. But, you know, as time goes on, we start getting more general insights into kind of the way things are. And these three, anicca, anatta, and dukkha, the three characteristics are also called the three general characteristics. They're the impermanence of things, the impersonality of them, the insubstantiality, what he's really addressing in this sutta, the insubstantiality, and then the suffering that results when we don't recognize those first two are the insights that we are actually cultivating in this practice. Those are the insights that lead us all the way to liberation. Deeply understanding those three things lead us all the way to liberation. That's why I like this teaching on the aggregates, because they're all about deconstructing what we see as ourself and recognizing the three general characteristics of everything. So that'll become clearer as we go on here, I hope. The second, suppose, bhikkhus, that in autumn, when it is raining and big raindrops are falling, a water bubble arises and bursts on the surface of the water. A person with good sight would inspect it, ponder it, and carefully investigate it, and it would appear to be void, hollow, insubstantial. For what substance could there be in a water bubble? So too, bhikkhus, whatever kind of feeling tone there is, he uses feeling, but here we try to distinguish between the feeling of contact and this feeling tone, this idea that, or this experience, not an idea, this experience that everything that we encounter in life is accompanied by either pleasant, unpleasant, or neither, by neutral. So everything, the feeling tone that arises with experience, here he calls it feeling, but I'll change it to feeling tone. So too, bhikkhus, whatever kind of feeling tone there is, whether past, future, or present, internal, external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, a bhikkhu inspects it, ponders it, and carefully investigates it, and it would appear to be void, hollow, insubstantial. For what substance could there be in feeling tone? So for those of you that remember the teaching on the cycle of reactivity, you'll remember that in that sequence of the 12 links, the one that we teach we can first be conscious of is contact. There's some other ones before that that are subconscious. So contact is when any experience reaches any of the six sense doors, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, or thoughts in the mind. When any experience touches any of those, that's contact. So a sound touches the ear, a smell touches the nose, a taste touches the tongue, a sensation touches the skin, or a thought comes into the mind, or a visual object touches the eye. We have a healthy eye. If the sense is healthy, it's transmitted to the, we know now it's the brain. Buddha didn't use that language. There's an instantaneous, intuitive response of the system of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral to that experience. Some teachers say that's too subtle to recognize, maybe, but it's helpful, I think, to know that that's what's happening with any experience, because it arises and then, boom, it's gone. Just like a bubble on the surface of the water, because the next experience follows and the same thing happens. We react to that, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. And it's not a conscious reaction. It's not, I like this, I don't like that, I didn't even notice that happened. You know, that's pleasant. That's what happens to pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral when we're not aware of them and they escalate. But this, here we're talking about an ethically neutral, morally neutral, intuitive response of the system to any experience of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. So the experience happens, boom, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral is expressed, and poof, it disappears like the bubble on the surface of water. So for us to say, oh, that's my pleasantness, or I like it when it's pleasant, I want it to stay that way forever, that's suffering. That's a form of suffering. Expecting pleasant to last is going to result in suffering because it won't. Expecting unpleasant to go away just because we don't like it is suffering, because these things don't obey our will. Some people, teachers for a while, were using this phrase I kind of liked, but I haven't heard it. So it was like 2 or 3 months, all the teachers were using it, and then I didn't hear it again. It was the out-of-controlness of experience, that things just happen. We have no control over them, over the outer event happening, right? We have some control over our response, but we don't have any control over whether that strikes us as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. You know, we can take, you know, this clock falling off the table, unpleasant. We can not notice that unpleasant reaction and get irritated because something hasn't gone our way. And then if you notice the irritation, you know, it depends on where you notice what's happening. If we notice the irritation, we can do something about that. We can choose at that point to say, well, that's silly. You know, the clock just fell off the table. It's no big deal. Not noticing that can escalate into more and more unpleasantness. That's what we call the cycle of reactivity. So this aggregate way of looking at it is just starting from the real basics of experience and recognizing, oh, that's how I create a self. I create a self by thinking that pleasant, unpleasant, neutral is something that I have control over or something that I can be in charge of. Third one. Suppose, bhikkhus, that in the last month of the hot season, we're talking about the Ganges Valley of India now, okay? I mean, Sacramento gets hot, but the last month of the hot season, you know, right before the rains come, it's hot. Suppose, bhikkhus, that in the last month of the hot season, at high noon, a shimmering mirage appears. A person with good sight would inspect it, ponder it, and carefully investigate it, and it would appear to him to be void, hollow, and insubstantial. For what substance could there be in a mirage? So too, bhikkhus, whatever kind of perception there is, so perception is the third one, whatever kind of perception there is, whether past, future, or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, a bhikkhu inspects it, ponders it, and carefully investigates it, and it would appear to him, he says to him, let's just say to them, to be void, hollow, insubstantial, for what substance could there be in perception? So perception is this amazing ability that the human mind has to recognize something and put a label on it. So there is the bare experience of seeing, right? I mean, I'm looking out and I could describe what I'm seeing now as various patches of color in various shapes with a little bit of movement going on and, you know, a wall back there with, well, not a wall, but a flat surface with a certain color and so forth, right? There is that bare experience of seeing. It does exist. But the human mind is so quick that it immediately, this has allowed us to survive, by the way, immediately labels it as something. It calls it wall, or it calls it person, or it calls it John. It puts a label on something, number one, so that it can know friend or foe, fight, flight, or freeze, right? That's the survival function of perception. So it's a little bit confusing because sometimes in scientific terms we use perception just for that quality of bare seeing. But in this practice, in this teaching, we use perception to be the next step after that. The ability of the mind to just label something. The problem with that is that what the mind is trying to do in that labeling process is put everything in a box. And many of our experiences don't fit those boxes. So when a novel experience comes along, our first tendency is to drop that into an existing box. We don't even want to recognize it as novel. So there's a movie called that's about perception that shows someone flashing a deck of cards. And so the card flashes across the screen and you're asked to remember what the card was. So they just show these cards. They're random, you know, red one, there's a black one, there's a red one, three of spades, four of clubs, you know, five of hearts, king of diamonds. And then one comes by, and I forget the time, it's around a half a second, but I forget the time interval, but this card goes by, and you can't, at least when I did it, I could not perceive what that card was. It was up there as long as all the other ones. You know, it had the, so let's just say it was a jack of diamonds. The J was there, you know, kind of recognized that, but I couldn't get my head around what it was. It's because the diamond was black. So diamonds are usually red. The mind wants to put that perception, that visual object, the card that has the black jack of diamonds, wants to put that into the familiar box, but it doesn't fit. Okay? So now I know, we used to look at that, the movie was called Paradigm. So we used to look at that to be able to talk to people about paradigm shifts and why that's so difficult. Why is it so difficult to get climate change? We see evidence of it all around us. Why is that so hard, other than the fact that You know, if you really got it, you realize that there's some really, really, really bad stuff going on. But I mean, other than that, other than the unpleasantness of it, why is it so hard to get? It's because it doesn't fit our paradigm. You know, I mean, there's a few scientists that recognized decades ago that this was going on, but the paradigm just doesn't fit the way we're living our lives. That's the problem. It doesn't fit into the old box. So that black jack of diamonds does not fit into the box that diamonds are red. So it goes right by us. We cannot process it, literally. The mind cannot grasp that concept. So we need to watch out for this also in our meditation, that when an insight occurs that doesn't fit the old boxes, whether that's our old concept of ourself, whether that's what we thought was supposed to happen in meditation. Oh, well, I thought meditation was supposed to be calm, but when I sat down today, it was all jumbled and jangly and upsetting. Hello, that's life sometimes, you know? So we need to be really careful with this quality of perception that we don't unconsciously allow it to fit novel experiences into the old box. This practice is about change, right? If there was no possibility of change, this is where impermanence is our friend. If there was no possibility of change, there would be no purpose in doing the practice, because if we're not going to change, why even do it? We'd be the same, I mean, physically would not, but you know, our mind would still be in the same place it was when we started practicing if we weren't open to change. The other thing that's scary about perception is that perception has the extraordinary ability to show us what we want to see, what is present. And I learned this as a bird watcher. You know, as a bird watcher, you're not seeing, you're looking. Okay, there's a difference. Sayadaw Tejaniya teaches us about that, and I'll teach more about, he has a new book out, so I'm going to teach more about him again this year. I haven't done that in a while. But he teaches the difference between looking and seeing. So seeing is just receiving through the visual sense door and being aware that we're seeing. Looking is going out to the object world and trying to find something out there, okay? Seeing is receiving the sense objects and recognizing what's happening internally in response to those. So birdwatchers look. That's what we do. We do not just allow, you know, visual images to scroll across without really doing some heavy-duty perception. So what that allows the mind to do, if we're not careful, is that we'll actually turn what we're seeing into what we want to see. So, for example, we often have the experience of seeing a clump of leaves or a small branch and thinking that's a bird. I've had that happen. I can't tell you. Happens every time I go out almost, because I want to see birds. So when I see something that has that vague shape, you know, it becomes a bird in my mind until I look more closely. And how does he say? Inspect it, ponder it, and carefully investigate it. If you don't do that, you know, it could stay a bird in your mind. So, you know, it's really interesting, the people that sort of curate the observing of birds, they will ask you for very detailed observations of, you know, everything that you saw about that. Because they understand this tendency of the mind, this ability, this extraordinary ability of the mind to take a novel experience and put it in an old box. So we need to watch for that one. And again, this ability to label things instantly is another way that we create a self. We see something and we relate it to the self. We see something, not me. We see something, mine. We see something, friend. We see something, foe, right? Most of those are probably assumptions rather than facts, but that's what the mind does. So we have to watch for that one. We need awareness of that one. The fourth one. Suppose, bhikkhus, that a person needing heartwood, seeking heartwood, wandering in search of heartwood, would take a sharp axe and enter a forest. Okay, good start. There, they would see the trunk of a large plantain tree. Plantain's like a banana. In fact, this book translates it as banana tree. Would see the trunk of a large plantain tree, straight, fresh, without a fruit bud core. Bananas, you know, have that big hanging thing off them, so this one doesn't have that. It's nice and straight. They would cut it down at the root, cut off the crown, and unroll the coil. You know how banana tree is really just almost like a giant leaf that's rolled up. As they unroll the coil, they would not even find softwood, let alone heartwood. A person with good sight would inspect it, ponder it, and carefully investigate it, and it would appear to be void, hollow, insubstantial. For what substance could there be in the trunk of a plantain tree? So too, bhikkhus, whatever kind of volitional formations there are. This is the fourth one. Volitional formations. We'll get to that. Whether past, future, or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near. So do you get what that list is about? Past, present, future, internal or external, far or near. It means every example of this. That's what they're trying. That's what lists like that mean in Pali language, Pali syntax. When they give you every possible parameter, it means everything. They just lay it out in more detail than just saying every single kind. Instead, they say it this way. A bhikkhu inspects them, ponders them, and carefully investigates them. As he investigates them, they appear to be void, hollow, insubstantial. For what substance could there be in volitional formations? So volitional formations, the fourth one, the Pali word is sankhara. It probably has more meanings than any other word that's used in the Pali canon. So the simplest way I can think of explaining it without keeping you all night is that sankhara are patterns. They are the patterns that our mind forms out of habit. Those of a certain cosmology might say that some of our patterns even go prior to our own birth, that we inherit them from past lives. And, you know, there's stories of, well, I mean, there's stories of little boys playing with trucks, you know, even though other toys are available to them. There's some kind of pattern there. Maybe the parents that are imposing that, but something that wasn't necessarily taught. There are cultural patterns that we all have, that we follow, cultural norms. There are unhealthy self-talk patterns that we repeat over and over again. These are all sankhara. These are all mental formations, they're sometimes called. He calls them volitional formations because the more volition, the more intention, you know, we talk about the power of intention in here, the more intention that's behind a thought, word, or deed, the stronger groove that makes in the mind. It makes it easier to fall into that groove again in the future. So that's what sankhara is about. That's about these repeated patterns that we fall into again and again. So it's the power of habit is what it is. So think of it as a pattern. Those aren't substantial either, but we really strongly identify with them. We think, I am an anxious person if we have a mental pattern of falling into anxiety. We may think of ourselves as being intelligent. We may think of ourselves as being timid or shy. All of these are just habit patterns. They aren't who we are. They're habit patterns that we take to be ourself. And In the Buddha's view, they're as hollow as empty. Empty, remember, emptiness in the Buddhist context means subject to conditions. Emptiness in the Buddhist context means that nothing has a permanent, continuing essence that's going to last forever and that's unchanging, because everything is the result of causes and conditions that preceded it. So just like the empty trunk of a banana tree, the experience of life, everything that we experience is the result of causes and conditions, not of things being solid and having this continuing essence. So what we see as me is really just a habit pattern that we've developed over time. And thank goodness, those can change, you know, with insights into the suffering that some of our thought patterns cause us. So that's, we could spend a lot more time on Sankara, on volitional formations, but that's where we'll leave it for now. The last one. Suppose, bhikkhus, that a magician or magician's apprentice would display a magical illusion at a crossroads. A person with good sight would inspect it, ponder it, and carefully investigate it, and it would appear to be void, hollow, insubstantial. For what substance could there be in a magical illusion? So too, bhikkhus, whatever kind of consciousness there is, that's the fifth one, consciousness, whether past, future, or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, a bhikkhu inspects it, ponders it, and carefully investigates it, and it would appear to him to be void, hollow, insubstantial. For what substance could there be in consciousness? Now, this is a really tricky one in English, because we think of, in the psychological, Western psychological realm, we think of consciousness as being kind of a permanent thing. We think of like primal consciousness or the subconscious as something that's sort of always happening. But that's not what the Buddha's talking about here. What he's talking about is the consciousness that rises in response to contact. So the Buddhist idea of consciousness is that there's a contact between the sense and the sense object. The feeling tone arises, and perception happens. And then the idea of vijnana, of consciousness, is that when we're seeing and we're aware of seeing, eye consciousness is arising. When we're tasting, when the taste object touches the tongue, taste consciousness arises. When that sensation stops, the consciousness fades with it. So that's what they mean when they're talking about consciousness. They're talking about the word that's used sometimes is cognition. It's the knowing. It's the knowing of an event or of a life experience. So, you know, we had perception, which was the recognizing of it, but then we have consciousness, which is the knowing of it. It's actually being aware that we just had an experience. So it's actually, in time, it's a little bit after the experience itself. It's knowing that the experience happened. Now, especially in this Western world, with our emphasis on intellectual knowing and achievement, this consciousness really is one that we identify with. You know, we think that we are thinking. That when consciousness happens, when we actually know something, you know, I look at that bell, I know that's a bell, and I know that I'm knowing that. It's not very hard to slip into thinking that I am the knower. It's very hard to remember that this process of seeing is just the result of causes and conditions. The cause, the sight object, the healthy sense door, the contact between those two, and then the knowing of it. It's a simple process, but we tend to take it personally. We tend to think, I am seeing, when actually all that's happening is a bunch of conditions are coming together and seeing is being known. So that's the fifth one. The handout that you have, we can move to that now, gives you all the Pali words for all these things in case you bump into them again. And what I do here is I relate the aggregates to dependent origination. I didn't come up with that originally. A whole bunch of the suttas in here do that. They splice the aggregates in with the cycle of reactivity with dependent origination, and they show how they relate to each other. So this fourth paragraph down here, the ones in brackets are the factors with independent origination that don't have an exact parallel in the five aggregates of clinging. I mean, there's 12 links to dependent origination, only five aggregates of clinging. So the formula for dependent origination is dependent on ignorance, mental formations arise. That's kind of the language of the way it's taught. So those are sankhara. That's one of the aggregates. Dependent on mental formations, consciousness arrives. Dependent on consciousness, form arises. Dependent on form, the six sense doors, perception, feeling tone, and then craving, clinging, attachment, identification. These are all the ways that we suffer if we let this process roll out. So the whole purpose of this teaching, as was the whole purpose of all the teaching that the Buddha did, was to come to the end of suffering, right? That was the whole purpose of his teaching, as he told us many times. So this quote from the book, Clinical Handbook of Mindfulness, the Buddha saw that all experience involves a process in which the raw data streaming into the mind, so we talked about that, right? Just the bare seeing, just the bare experience of that, into the mind through the sense doors is compiled and synthesized into a virtual world of meaning. Okay? It's not direct knowledge. Once our wonderful minds get a hold of it and start churning it around, start passing it through our past experiences, our memories, our thoughts, our views, we're compiling it and synthesizing it into a virtual world of meaning. There are five primary categories or systems whereby the information flowing through these sense doors is processed. That's their way. These are modern-day psychologists. And Andy Olensky is a Buddhist scholar that was at the Buddhist, the Berry Center for Buddhist Studies. But that's their framing of the five aggregates of clinging. They're the five ways that information flowing through the sense doors is processed. That's a nice way of thinking of it. Had one other nice summary of them from Joseph Goldstein. He says, the great import of these teachings of the five aggregates is that they provide a framework for our experiential analysis of what we call self. So, you know, with Joseph, it's all about direct experience, right? This isn't an intellectual game. This is all about our direct experience. So he says, the great import of these teachings of the five aggregates is that they provide a framework for our experiential analysis, actually knowing from our direct experience what we call self. How is it that we build this creation called self? And that's one of the doors to awakening, is to recognize the ways in which we create this thing called self, and then to eventually deconstruct that and recognize the way things are, which is that everything's insubstantial, it's impermanent, and it causes suffering. So our practice involves knowing the arising and passing away, understanding that the aggregates, which represent all conditioned things, it's the way we process our life experience, are impermanent, understanding that even pleasant aggregates are suffering because they change. So on the back side of this handout, I've given you a little opportunity for practice. So the first paragraph just repeats kind of the overview of the aggregates, which is the way that we process all conditioned things. And then there's kind of a thought experiment that calls out all five of the aggregates in a brief description of an experience and shows you how each of these might be experienced in daily life. And then relates it to the cycle of reactivity, how and why we suffer because we hold on, and then personalize experience and identify with it. So in the second to last paragraph, you can read this in detail later, but second to last paragraph, I say, in the days ahead, see if you can sense the cycle of reactivity at work before it reaches the stage of harmful speech and action. Note when a feeling tone of pleasant or unpleasant arises. Note when unpleasant turns to aversion or pleasant escalates to desire. Note when the mind shifts from I would prefer this to I need this. In short, note when the mind clings to the five aggregates. That's why these are called the five aggregates of clinging, is that these are the ways that we can break down our experience into the things that we actually hold on to. And as we know for the second noble truth, that holding on is what causes our suffering. And recognizing that, the task of the second noble truth is that that is to be abandoned. So the only way we're going to abandon that is to actually become aware of it as it happens. So give that a try. Let me know how it goes. And good luck. Any questions, comments? Yes.
I remember when my father at 79 or 80 came back from India and China, and he was in a hospital being cared for by people that didn't speak his language, that were caring for him with medicine that he didn't understand, around Nixon's era. He came back and he said to Chris and I thought I knew how the world worked. And I now realize I have no idea. Mm-hmm. And he was, at that point, the happiest he had ever been in his life. Mm. And somehow he got released from the binds of his belief systems
yeah.
that he had been carrying with him and looking at the world through for all of his life.
Right. That's excellent. That also illustrates the first kind of clinging that I didn't talk about as much tonight. So in the teachings, there are two main kinds of clinging to watch out for. One is the clinging to identity view, which I talked about quite a bit tonight. But this is the first one, actually, and it's clinging to wrong views. So there's someone that was able to let go of that. What was the result? Happiness. Right? Suffering disappeared because there was a letting go of a wrong view. So great. Thank you for that.
The first one meaning the material form?
No, I was just talking about the two different ways that we hang on. So these are called the five aggregates of clinging. We can hang on to any of them, but we do it in two different ways. One is that we do it through the view of myself.
Right.
This is my form. This is my perception. This is my consciousness, whichever one it is. But the other way we do it is by wrong view. We cling to our misunderstanding of the way things really are.
Oh.
So, yeah. So we see a form.
Fall under the perception.
Can fall under any of them.
Okay.
Right. Wrong view can fall under any of them. So we see a form, and generally, I don't know about you, but when I see a form, I assume that it's going to be that way forever. Right? That's a wrong view. It's not going to be that way forever. None of us are going to be the way we are even tomorrow, much less 30 years from now. You know, even that bell, I mean, it looks like it's going to last forever. It's not. I know from experience.
So it's like when you reach that level of acceptance, technically saying it won't last forever, so
yeah.
This feeling
mm.
it's in this present moment.
Yep.
Once you kind of let go of that, and that's part of the meditation of in this present moment, those senses and everything, it slowly gets you to that.
That's right.
Point of acceptance.
Yes.
And then you could release. You will no longer feel the anxiety and the,
yes,
which is part of the aggregates that you're talking about.
Yes. That it's the difference between concept and direct experience. So what you just described of being in the present moment, noticing what's happening with our senses and all, that's direct experience. It's what some people call ultimate reality, because it's just what's happening in the moment. It's actually real. Whereas our concepts about it, oh, I'm doing a really good job meditating right now. You know, that's just a concept. That's the relative world, right? We need them both, but I'm just pointing out that direct experience is what we're after in this practice. What we can learn from direct experience is what we're after. So, thank you. Yeah.
In your example with the phone call,
when, yeah,
you're doing a project,
uh-huh,
is there something in there that you would label consciousness?
Yeah, I left that one out. Well, I called it the sound. So it was knowing the sound of the voice. So it's actually a combination there of a sankara. So you're knowing, when you hear that voice, you kind of know it's a telemarketer, you know, but you know. You are knowing that perception. You're aware of that perception, and you're making a choice based on that perception. So it's gone just beyond just the pure perception to a knowing of it, and then a choice based on that knowing. Yeah. There was one over here.
Yeah, so it gets complicated, which I'm sure is no surprise to you. Like, with people who aren't practicing this or whatever, they're like, I'll have friends say, oh, aren't you glad such and such happened? Or how are you today? Or so, I'm reaching this point where I can't answer them anymore.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I'm getting very clear on, just because I think something is one way today doesn't mean it's going to turn out that way. And it seemed to resonate with perception, maybe?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's...
Could you repeat that?
Yeah, yeah. What she's talking about is the challenge when you start to recognize kind of the ultimate nature of the way things are, when you recognize that your perception isn't necessarily accurate, that the way you're feeling today isn't necessarily going to be how you're feeling tomorrow, and then someone asks you, well, how are you doing? Right? And so there's this interplay in practice between kind of being true to what you've sort of realized in your insights and really understanding what the other person is asking.
Yeah.
So this is where, you know, the sensitivity to where the other person is coming from maybe overrides the necessity to be speaking from a position of ultimate truth 24/7, right?
The harder one,
yeah.
Aren't you glad such and such? Well, I don't know yet.
Yeah, right. Yeah. You know, Sayadaw Huche Janiyah says the more he practiced, the less he talked. but there is something, you know, we always talk about when we come off retreat, you know, and the first person asks, how was your retreat? You know, don't give them a detailed explanation of every single minute sensation you had in your knee as the excruciating pain was playing out over a 45-minute sitting, right? That's not what they want. They want to know if you were okay, right? So you say, it was great, and then see if they come back with more. So someone said, well, aren't you glad that happened, you know? I mean, what I'll do, I'll just say, we'll see,
yeah.
You know? We'll see. If the overriding thing in your mind is, I really don't know, we need to wait to see how this turns out. You know, just allow the process to play out. But it is a real challenge to kind of in that play, in that realm of interpersonal relations with people that aren't practicing, about what's a skillful way for addressing what they're really asking, okay? Somebody says, how are you? You know, that could mean, how are you? You know, what's going on in your life right now? It could also mean, I'm passing you in the hallway, how are you? Whatever, you know, that they it's just a nicety, you know, which is so nice. That's another reason it's so nice on retreat that we drop all those niceties and don't have to worry about them. But yeah, I would say the thing to do there is to try to figure out what it is that the person's really asking, and do they really want a serious answer or not, you know? And, I mean, you know, they caution against idle chatter, but there is an element of, well, you know, that one was kind of, I mean, it's helpful for all of us. It was kind of more directed toward the monks. He wanted them to always be talking about the Dhamma. But when we encounter folks on a daily basis, you know, just keep in mind our intention that we don't want to do any harm and that we'll want to be kind in general. And then try to react to what the person's really asking rather than the surface of it. And I think that can kind of be a guide to an appropriate response. Yeah, someone said, what is the path of practice? And the person said an appropriate response. So that's what we're looking for.
Rich, it seems like this the aggregates of clinging are a product of, you know, cognitive experience. This is the formation of beliefs and perceptions, etc. And the sutra stated as the anecdote, investigation,
right,
and observation. And I find that interesting because so often our concept of investigation is more cognition, cognitive questioning. But correct me, or does he mean investigation in the sense of pure observation of what's what, of the experience of it, not a cognitive questioning of it?
Yes. You know, the wording was pondering it, observing it, and investigating it. So the observing is the what you're talking about, the, you know, the direct seeing of it. The investigation, remember, in this practice, turns inward. So the investigation is to actually see how that plays out in our experience. Whatever the external event was, how does that play out in experience? What's our attitude toward that? What's arising in terms of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral? You know, are we liking it, not liking it? Are we holding on to it or pushing it away? All of those, you're right, they're mental processes, but they're not this sort of cognitive wondering, you know, analyzing in an intellectual way. It's a direct experience.
Yeah, so they're not trying to answer the question why.
Right.
They're asking the question what.
What?
What is going on
what
in my mind?
What process is going on, yeah.
Great.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, thank you. Pondering, you know, which is kind of another word that we use for that is reflection, reflecting on it. We don't often do that a lot in meditation, but we try to do that in our daily life, you know, kind of look back on how did the day go and, you know, that sort of thing. And then investigating it. And investigation in this practice is actually seeing internally how things play out when we have any experience, yeah. All right, well, let's close with a dedication of merit, understanding that this practice really is about relieving suffering, both for ourselves and for those around us. And so supporting each other's intentions to truly be kind, to truly do everything we can to lessen and ultimately eliminate the suffering of all beings. And may whatever positive energy we've generated here tonight by meditating together, by speaking together at the break, by our Dharma discussion, whatever positive energy we've generated, may that incline toward relieving the suffering of all beings. May all beings be safe and protected, peaceful and happy, as healthy and as strong as their current circumstances allow. And may all beings know the true ease of well-being and be free of suffering. Thank you for your practice.